I'll give Omar a proper introduction in a moment, but just to say, when it became clear that he would not be allowed into the country, he insisted that we go forward via video feed, and we started to make arrangements for that, and then I realized, wow, it will be 3 a.m. for you, Omar. Are you sure? You ready to do this? And he said, absolutely, this is very important to me, and in particular, it was very important, which meant a lot to me and to us, that he speak at Tzedek Chicago at a synagogue, which was part of his itinerary. So we are just so thrilled and honored that we're able to go forward with this conversation. And we thank you for staying up early in the morning, Omar, for this program. So welcome, everyone. Welcome to our program. It's entitled BDS and Liberation, a Passover Conversation with Omar Barghouti. And the genesis of this program began several months ago when Omar contacted us here in Chicago, as he did other friends and colleagues throughout the country, planning to come to the United States and planning various stops and meetings and programs, and also was coming for his daughter's wedding, which is this Sunday. And we made arrangements for him to speak with Tzedek Chicago because he articulated a desire to speak at a synagogue, which is a first. This really is, I think, a very historic moment that we are hosting the co-founder of the BDS movement in a synagogue and in a synagogue setting on the day before Passover. Yeah. And as the day grew closer, we started to make more preparations, and Omar made more preparations for meetings and programs on the East Coast. And just last week, we learned that although he had received a visa, he was barred at the airport, at Ben Gurion Airport, by U.S. immigration from getting on the airplane and was unable to come to the United States. And that's when, as I said, he articulated a very, very strong desire to go forward with these programs, and he has. And you may have seen some of them. He was on Democracy Now! Recently. He was part of a program with Rebecca Vilcomerson of Jewish Voice for Peace and Mark Lamont Hill, the professor at Temple University, as part of a conversation there. He had a conversation with Peter Beinart about a week ago. So as far as I know, I would say most of the planned stops along the itinerary, Omar, you've been able to hold to?
I couldn't hear the last sentence very well.
Most of the plans that you made to show up at appearances in the United States, you've been able to do via video?
All of them, not all most. Them.
So as I mentioned...
Except my daughter's wedding. I cannot do it via Skype.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that up until even today, you were looking into the possibility of being able to come out for her wedding.
Yeah, but it's impossible. We found out with this administration, things take a long time to get justice.
Yeah. And that is, in fact, going to be a theme of our conversation tonight. And we are so sorry that you're not able to be present for your daughter's wedding, and we are eminently aware of the injustice of that on so many levels, but we are just honored to be able to host you tonight in our congregation and in our community here in Chicago.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
So I want to say just a few words before we continue with our conversation. When Omar mentioned to me that he was very interested in speaking in a synagogue and we looked at the date, we realized it was literally the day before Passover. And it occurred to me that this was perfect. This really was perfect because we are going to be talking about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. We're going to be talking about the political ramifications of it and some of the struggles that have arisen around the attempts to criminalize BDS in this country and around the world. And that has been the subject of many of the programs that Omar has been holding throughout his trip. But it seemed to me that there was something special about this particular conversation, it being in the context of a synagogue the day before Passover. And that is that beyond all of the political discussion, which is very important and we will, of course, have, BDS is a liberation movement. And there is something intrinsically powerful about a synagogue having a conversation with the co-founder of the Palestinian movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions on the eve of Passover, because the Passover story is a liberation story. And central to that story is the lesson that when the oppressed cry out, God responds to the cry of the oppressed and demands justice. BDS is a call from the oppressed. That is what it is at its core. And we'll learn more about that. The BDS civil society call was a call for solidarity and for justice on the part of the Palestinian people. And that, with all of the, I believe, with all of the conversation and debate about the political ramifications of BDS and, you know, is it anti-Semitism? Isn't it anti-Semitism? Combating the legislation that is criminalizing it. We lose sight of the fact that it, at its very core, is posing a central question to us, and that is, we are seeking justice. This is a nonviolent call for justice on the part of the Palestinian people. Will you stand with us? And that is a question that's been laid before us by the Palestinian people, as it has been posed by oppressed peoples throughout history. So it's altogether appropriate that we are having this conversation in a synagogue on Passover to find about how to explore ways that we can participate in this liberation process and to answer the call that has been placed before us. So as I mentioned, Omar Barghouti is the co-founder of the Movement for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. He and I had the opportunity this afternoon to have a brief conversation on WBEZ on Worldview. If any of you tuned in, you didn't hear that conversation because the Mueller report wiped everything off of WBEZ's schedule. However, that conversation will go forward sometime next week. So if there are still questions that are unanswered after this evening, we encourage you to tune in next week as well. But I wanted to begin, Omar, with a question that was posed by Jerome McDonald, the host of World, and that is just to tell us a little bit about how this latest incident, this latest barring of your entrance into the United States transpired, and to maybe put it into a larger context of the backlash that is occurring against BDS and BDS activists worldwide.
Thanks for that, Brett. But before addressing that, I must express my real happiness for being with you in a synagogue for the first time ever, not because I did not want to, because no synagogue would receive me in the U.S. It was too difficult, too controversial. Although in Jewish tradition, controversy is part of tradition, but there are limits. So I'm really happy to be with you and to have this discussion before Passover. Happy Passover, everyone. At a time of the rise of the far right and white supremacy and the massacre we saw at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, no one should take racism lightly. Anti-Semitism, anti-Black, anti-Muslim, anti-Arab racism, anti-LGBT discrimination is definitely on the rise. Anti-Indigenous is racism is also on the rise. So we have to take that very, very seriously. Within this context, I can address what happened to me by being not allowed to enter the United States after having lived in the U.S. for 11 years. I went to school in the U.S. I got married in the U.S. I had my first child in the U.S. And I've regularly toured the United States. To be banned so out of the blue, to me, meant that Israel was exporting this micro-oppression of human rights defenders who are active in the BDS movement. And this is very dangerous, not just for the Palestinian struggle and for solidarity with the Palestinians, but for everyone who cares about the rule of law and about human rights and protecting our right as human rights defenders to speak truth to power. So this ban really hurts, but it does not deter me. I'm determined to continue on my path because I think that's a very important, morally consistent, nonviolent path towards justice, freedom, and equality for everyone, irrespective of identity.
Thank you. I'd like to begin further by just laying out a little bit about this, the basic history of the BDS, the civil society BDS call, how it emerged, what it is essentially, and maybe a few words about how it has unfolded and evolved until this point today.
BDS was launched by the absolute majority of Palestinian civil society in 2005. By absolute majority, I mean all the women's unions and youth and academics and political parties and just about every main entity in Palestinian society endorsed BDS. It is inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement and the U.S. civil rights movement. It is anchored in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and as such, it rejects all forms of discrimination and racism, including anti-Semitism and every other form of racism. And we're very clear about this as a matter of principle, not as a matter of tactics. So what is BDS? It calls for the three basic rights of the Palestinian people, without which we cannot exercise self-determination, which is an inalienable right under international law. The first right is ending the 1967 occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, the Syrian Golan Heights. Number two, ending the system of inequality that exists in Israel pre-67 border against all indigenous Palestinians who are not Jewish. Christian Muslim Palestinians are discriminated against by law, not just by policy. So we want to end that racial discrimination, which amounts to apartheid, according to the UN definition. The third right is the right of refugees, in accordance with UN resolutions, to return to their homes of origin, from which they were expelled systematically during the 1948 Nakba. Why do we focus on all three rights, not just ending the 67 occupation? Because Palestinians are not just those in the occupied territories. Palestinians in the occupied territories constitute 38% only of the Palestinian people. 12% are Palestinian citizens of present-day Israel, and 50% are Palestinians in exile, not allowed to go home. Even among Palestinians in Israel and Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, there's a very significant minority of internal refugees or internally displaced persons. Many of you may not know, but even among Palestinian citizens of Israel, there's about a 20% minority who are refugees in their own homeland, and they cannot go to their original villages because they're not Jewish. They're citizens already of Israel. They're not coming from refugee camps in Syria or Lebanon or Jordan. They're living there already, but they live sometimes a mile away from their original village, and they're denied the right to go home, even despite Supreme Court decisions allowing them to go home, as in the Ayn Hod case and some other cases.
So I know that in the Jewish community there is a spectrum of responses to the BDS call. I believe there is a growing support in the Jewish community, particularly among the younger generation, and I want to address that in a little bit. But I wanted to ask you to articulate a little bit your thoughts on how this is resonating for Jews. I mean, and for Zionist Jews in particular. On the one end of the spectrum, there are those who just see the BDS call as thoroughly anti-Semitic and, you know, a form of economic terrorism, quote-unquote. That's, I think, the most visceral and extreme response. But even among otherwise fairly liberal or progressive Jews, liberal Zionists, so-called, there is a principled opposition to BDS. And you often hear, even when they argue for the right for freedom of speech for BDS and argue against the criminalization of BDS, they'll take pains to say, well, we do not personally agree with BDS, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to me that from a liberal Zionist point of view, the sticking point is the third part of the call, the right of return, which even for a liberal Zionist is tantamount to the end of the Jewish state as we know it. And I wanted to read to you just a quick excerpt from an op-ed that I know you read in the New York Times by Michelle Goldberg, who I believe you were planning to meet, or she indicated she was hoping to speak with you on this trip. And it was in an otherwise, I think, wonderful article, but then she articulated that point of view toward the end of her article. And I just wanted to read it for you and ask you to respond a little bit. She writes, The movement is agnostic on a final dispensation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but it calls for the right of Palestinian refugees, both those displaced by the creation of Israel and their descendants, to return to their familial homes, which would likely end Israel's Jewish majority. Barghouti told me personally he believes in the creation of a single state in which Israeli Jews as individuals would have civil rights, but Jews as a people would not have national rights. I'd planned to argue with him about this view, which is largely dismissive of Jewish claims on Israel and would likely lead to oppression or worse for Israeli Jews. My guess is that many, if not most, Jews find such a position offensive, even frightening. So pretend I'm Michelle Goldberg and I'm posing that question to you, as she was hoping to do when she saw you. Before I do, I just want to say that I personally would take exception to her claim that many, if not most, Jews find the idea of a single state where there are equal rights for all citizens to be, quote-unquote, offensive. I'm not in agreement there. But I would like you to respond to her question that she was planning to ask you personally, which is, what about this issue of the right of return?
It was a long question, so there are quite a few points. The first point is that Michelle Goldberg missed or omitted a key part of my answer, which was written, by the way. It wasn't oral, so she could miss it. It's written, and I have it, and one day I will publish it. My full answer is much more nuanced than that. And she was asking me about my personal opinion, not the BDS movement, because the BDS movement does not take a position on one state versus two states. It insists on basic rights, and that's it. She asked me, what's your personal opinion? I said, I've published my personal opinion. I support a secular democratic state for everyone without discrimination against anyone based on identity. So she said, what about the Jewish claim to self-determination, national rights to establish a Jewish state in Palestine? I said, no sane Palestinian will ever accept a supremacist state in Palestine, as we would object to a Christian supremacist state, an Islamic supremacist state. We most certainly will reject a Jewish supremacist state. Why would any sane indigenous population accept colonizers' right to have a supremacist system first? So this is just totally irrational. The second point is, I said, in a secular democratic state, Jewish persons would not just have civil rights. She misquotes me there. I said they should, they deserve all collective as well as individual rights, with the exception of national rights, because the right to self-determination was never meant to be for colonizers in a colonized territory. If Jewish people all over the world define themselves as a people, as a nation, that's certainly up to them. No one else can decide for Jews whether they constitute a nation, a religious group, an ethnic group, or whatever. It's up to Jewish persons to decide. Assuming they do decide, that still does not give this collective the right to ethnically cleanse people from a certain land to so-called exercise self-determination. Now, some Zionist thinkers were very honest, like Ze'ev Jabotinsky. Since the 1920s, Jabotinsky wrote, Zionist colonization, and I'm quoting, Zionist colonization of Palestine cannot proceed with the approval of the native population, because native populations always reject colonizers. So you have to build an iron wall, he called it, that the natives cannot breach. What he meant by an iron wall, to use hegemonic power and to drive them into despair so that they will never dare to resist the colonizers. But to Zionist leaders at that time, their project was very clear. It's colonizing Palestine. The lies that it was an empty land and so on were just lies for consumption outside. But they knew that there is an indigenous people. Now, I was asked by Peter Beinart in that discussion, what about Jews? Don't they have any indigenous rights? I mean, many Jews consider themselves indigenous to Palestine. I said, of course. As what we call today the Palestinian people has always had Jewish persons. The Palestinian people were never pure or monolithic. We were always a very, very diverse people for a simple reason. Just about every civilization on earth occupied Palestine at one point. So we're such a rich mix, a very diverse people, the most impure people on earth, possibly, the Palestinians. And we're proud of that. It's our heritage. We're proud of our diversity. And certainly, Jewishness and Judaism were always part of this heritage, part of this indigenous Palestinian people. But that doesn't allow European colonizers to colonize Palestine under the name of Judaism and claim that this is some divine right. The second point is that the famous Jewish writer I.F. Stone wrote with amazing, amazing vision back in 1967 about Israel the following. Israel is creating a moral schizophrenia in world Jewry. In the outside world, the welfare of Jewry depends on the maintenance of secular, non-racial, pluralistic societies. In Israel, Jewry finds itself defending a society in which mixed marriages cannot be legalized, in which non-Jews have a lesser status than Jews, and in which the ideal is racist and exclusivist, end of quote. This was in 1967, the good old days. Imagine what I.F. Stone would say today about Israel with the so-called Jewish power fascist party, possibly joining the government soon. What would he say? So indeed, he points to a very important contradiction there. Jewish communities have thrived historically in more democratic, pluralistic societies, except in Israel. There's an insistence on racial purity, ethnic purity, and supremacy. Why should any sane people, a sane person, accept that?
And what about Goldberg's final point, which is that it would likely lead to an oppression of Israeli Jews?
I've argued, there's a book published by Jewish Voice for Peace a couple of years ago called On Antisemitism. I have a chapter in that book, a Palestinian perspective on antisemitism, if you will, with a BDS element to it. I highly recommend reading that book and my chapter. I argue in that chapter that colonizers are always terrified of the hypothetical rising of the oppressed, of the colonized, and that the colonized would do to the colonizers what the colonizers have been doing in reality to the colonized for decades. So they have this fear that if they rise up, they'll do to us what we've been doing to them. They will slaughter us and massacre us and ethnically cleanse us and so on. This did not happen in South Africa. In South Africa, the white Afrikaners said the exact same Zionist propaganda. Oh, those blacks, if they come to power, God save us. They will slaughter us and they will kill every white person and they'll throw us out into the sea and so on. It never happened. It never happened. Some cases here and there, but en masse, it never happened. Whites and blacks today form one nation. And that's a very important example for us. So this fear is partly racist, I would say, because it's kind of anti-Arab racism is kind of undertones of this statement. It's as if Arabs cannot be trusted to rule anywhere without slaughtering the minorities. Well, allow me to remind everyone, especially in the synagogue, Jewish communities thrived the most during the Middle Ages in Arab Muslim-ruled Andalusia, when Jewish culture, Jewish philosophy thrived. At the same time, in parallel, Jewish communities slaughtered, were subjected to pogroms in white Christian Europe. This superimposition of the treatment of Jewish communities with utter racism and very violent racism in Europe to the Arab East, this doesn't work. This wasn't part of our history. Palestinians have always included Jews. Arab communities have always included Jews. There are many Jewish communities that are indigenous in Arab countries, and they thrived. They weren't in ghettos, living in poverty and abused by some feudal lords. It was a very different reality. So Michelle Goldberg's fear, and whoever supports her view, their fear of this possible harm to Jewish communities in Palestine if Jews become a minority is really totally misplaced, if not worse.
That fear also reminds me of American slavery as well. And often when there were slave revolts that were violent, that was used by by white slaveholders as proof somehow, evidence. So see, they're incorrigibly violent. See what would happen, you know, if we gave them rights. And I think there's a certain kind of logic, I wonder if you would agree, that when the Israeli government pursues policies that are so oppressive, that invariably when a people are oppressed, they will resist oppression, and sometimes that resistance will be violent in nature. And that violence can often be used as evidence for the fact that they need to be kept in their place, and also proof that some kind of, you know, messianic idea of everyone being equal is just a pipe dream.
And actually, Brandt, just a quick comment on what you just said, which is very important. The Brazilian educator Paulo Freire once wrote that oppression is the beginning of violence. With the beginning of oppression, violence has already started. Any reaction by the oppressed to the oppressor, be it violent or nonviolent, is always just that, a reaction. As a human rights defender who is part of this nonviolent movement, I have a deep interest in ending all violence, whether the action of the oppressor or the reaction of the oppressed. I personally want to see an end to all violence. But to do that, we've got to end the root cause of violence, and that's occupation, ethnic cleansing, settler colonialism, and apartheid. Without ending oppression, there is no way to end violence from the oppressor and therefore violence from the oppressed.
So, thank you. I'd like to circle back to our conversation about the backlash against BDS that we're seeing. And you mentioned the United States, Israel has now outsourced the United States to bar people like you from coming into the country. And the opposite happens as well. Activists, Palestine Solidarity activists in this country are often kept from going into Israel as well. And we're also seeing this rise of anti-BDS legislation around the country and around the world. Would you say, what do you make of this? Would you say that this is evidence that the power dynamic has shifted and that BDS and activists and Palestinians have been put on the defensive? Or would you argue that the opposite, that it's a sign that it's being taken seriously?
Yes, thanks for that question. I think it indicates that BDS is really on the rise and beginning to influence the mainstream, so that Israel's lobby, whether the traditional Jewish establishment lobby or the Christian Zionist lobby, which is bigger in numbers, are terrified of this rise of Palestinian voices and solidarity with the Palestinian cause for freedom, justice, and equality. We're starting to have influence in mainline churches, in trade unions, among artists, among academic associations, among student groups, LGBTQ groups, women's groups, and so on and so forth. We're building excellent relations, intersectional alliances with Black communities, Latino-Latina communities, indigenous communities, and so on. Increasingly, Israel is becoming the poster boy for the ultra-right around the world. White supremacists now look up to Israel as the model, not just Trump. Trump uses Israel all the time as his model for the anti-Muslim ban, for the wall with Mexico, for every evil policy he espouses. He uses Israel as the silencing card, really. But he's not the only one. East European authoritarian regimes have always used Israel also as a way to cover up their very clear anti-Semitism. In fact, I want to quote, there was an article in Haaretz not too long ago, weeks ago, the leaders of three East European countries met in Israel, and all those were anti-immigrant and anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, of course, and there was an uproar among some liberal Zionists in Israel. In response to that uproar, that how can Israel receive clear, patent anti-Semites like Orban, for example, of Hungary? So there's, in response, Likud MK, Anat Berko, she summarized Netanyahu's politics in a single sentence. She said, quote, "They might be anti-Semites, but they're on our side," end of quote. Now, let's unpack this. It might sound funny, but let's unpack this. In this one sentence, what she said two things. First, that it is perfectly fine to be anti-Jewish as long as you love Israel. Israel today has no problem with anti-Semites, from crazy Christian Zionists who are waiting for the Messiah to come and slaughter all Jews who are not converted to Christianity. It doesn't get any more anti-Semitic than that. And Israel works with them as its best allies. And it says, you know, we'll work with you very closely, or we love you until the Messiah comes. And then we'll have some issues. So Israel is in bed with the anti-Semites club of the world, really. But the second thing she's saying, the last part, she said, they're on our side. Whose side? The first time the Zionist establishment in Israel is saying our side, meaning Israel, not world Jewry. So all the talk about Israel and the Jews are one and the same, suddenly it fell through the cracks, and suddenly our side is Israel. Who cares about hatred for Jews? We don't really give a damn. As long as they continue supporting us at the United Nations, pumping investments and so on, we love them. We don't care about anti-Semitism. So what Israel is saying, we don't care about anti-Jewish bigotry, and therefore we have to change the very definition of anti-Semitism, because it's such a weapon. It's used as a weapon. So we have to change it to include anti-Zionism, opposition to Israeli apartheid, BDS. Everything against Israel today is anti-Semitic, but actual anti-Jewish bigotry and hatred is not. It's okay.
You know, it's interesting, that whole question of our side and, you know, who are the sides and which side are you on? I think historically for Jews, there has been, I think because of historic anti-Semitism toward Jews and anti-Jewish oppression, there's been an inwardness in the Jewish community, and sort of particularly in Christian Europe in the Middle Ages, a sort of a us against them mentality. And I think for many Jews, many, many generations removed from that, there's the vestiges of that attitude still remain. And making that shift from the, you know, which side are you on, to not being about Jews and the rest of the world, Jews and you know, the horrible anti-Semites, but rather there's the side of the oppressed and the side of the oppressor. And I'm coming back again to the Passover story, that I think for some Jews, when they sit around the Seder table, when they read that story, they're filtering it through the Jewish historic experience. You know, the Israelites are the mythic exemplars of the Jewish experience throughout history. That's sort of the traditional way of understanding it. But I think increasingly for me, and I think maybe for others, that the mythic experience of the Israelites is not limited just to the Jewish people. It's actually indicative of all of the oppressed throughout history, whether they were Jewish or not. And in fact, the Exodus story has inspired liberation movements outside the Jewish community. The Exodus story was invoked very powerfully during the civil rights movement in this country, and you know, it is cherished in a very universal way. And I think many of us, in standing in solidarity with the Palestinian people, as we do with all people who are oppressed, we are in some way reclaiming what it means to be, you know, on our side. We're on the side of the oppressed. That God, in the Exodus story, demands that we stand against the oppressor and for the oppressed. And here's the hard part, I think, for many Jews. Even when it's Jews that are oppressing, as in the case of the state of Israel. That's a very, very difficult step for many Jews to take, to see that the tables have turned in that way. But I think my sense is, among the younger increasingly among a younger generation of Jews, it's not a difficult step to take. It's, you know, because Israel's actions have become so patently, obviously, clearly oppressive in so many just, you know, basic, obvious ways, they're not growing up with that baggage quite in the same way that my generation and earlier generations of Jews may have. Now, I'm not saying, you know, I'm speaking more perhaps anecdotally, but I do think that most Jewish community-sponsored studies are showing that identification with the state of Israel is on the wane with young people. Would you agree in your own travels through the... I'm curious to know about your own travels through the Palestine Solidarity world and your impression of Jewish participation in that, and if you see a shift occurring in the community or among young people in particular.
As a secular Palestinian, I also see some inspiration in the Passover story of liberation. I see it as a humanistic issue, liberation from oppression, organizing to liberate oneself from oppression. But that basically undermines the unethical dichotomy that Israel and the hardcore Zionist movement are pushing for, as well as anti-Semites. They're together in this argument that there's a dichotomy between Jews and the rest of the humanity. It's us versus them. This is a very unethical dichotomy that I think liberal Jewish communities are rejecting increasingly, especially millennials, although this room seems to be less millennial than my usual audiences in the U.S.
They're watching the live stream.
Which is refreshing. Which is refreshing, by the way. Usually I address much more pepper than salt. It's great to address so much salt. But we should replace this unethical dichotomy of Jews versus the rest of the world, which is very anti-Semitic, with an ethical dichotomy of oppressors versus oppressed, regardless of identity. And I think most progressive young Jews, and even progressive older Jews, obviously, can no longer reconcile their liberalism, their progressive values, with what Israel and Zionism stand for today, with the siege of Gaza, ethnic cleansing in the Negev and Jerusalem, expulsion of families in the Jordan Valley to build illegal colonies, 65 racist laws discriminating against citizens of Israel who are not Jewish, and so on and so forth. They don't want that to speak for them. That doesn't speak for their values. So that traditional PEP, you know, progressive except on Palestine term, is giving way increasingly with those Jewish millennials to a PIP, progressive including Palestine. Today, Palestine has very much been included in that progressive agenda. Today, on most US campuses, if you're progressive, you'd better have a position for Palestinian rights. Otherwise, you're not truly progressive. You're a hypocrite, because you would consider Palestinians less human, who do not deserve what you're fighting for in every other cause, LGBT rights and women's rights and Jewish rights and black rights. But when it comes to Palestinians, no. It's okay. It's okay for Jewish Israelis to oppress Palestinians, because after all, they're us. Well, Israel is saying this us is really being undermined. Us is them. It's not every Jewish person around the world, and we should take that very seriously.
So I just want to make a note that I'd like to try to attempt a hard stop on the hour so that we can allow Omar to get some much-needed sleep. And I want to have a little bit of time for question and answer. But before we do, I just wanted to address the issue of where the BDS movement is at this particular point and where you see it going. It feels to me, I've been personally involved in helping support many a mainline Protestant church divestment resolutions. And as you mentioned, almost all of them have now, in one way or another, with maybe some minor exceptions, have some kind of divestment, have supported divestment in some fashion. And that it feels to me that there was a huge flurry of campaign activity over the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years. And we're at a bit of a crossroads now, and I wonder if you would agree with that and if you had thoughts about future directions. And one thought that I have, and this was actually a question a colleague of mine urged me to ask you, is that we're starting to see now the nascent beginnings in the politics of this country of politicians starting to raise the issue of withholding aid to Israel. And even Jeremy Ben-Ami of J Street has gone publicly suggesting that that might possibly be something that we need to consider. And I know that we're going to see, my prediction at least, is that we're going to see more political support for the idea, or at least to entertain the idea of withholding aid, whether you would call that S of the BDS, you know, formal sanctions, or something maybe short of that. But do you see that as part of perhaps the future direction of the movement as well? But in general, I'm just curious if this particular point in time and some future directions.
Sure. I think BDS is indeed at a critical juncture. I think we're approaching a tipping point, and there are many indicators of that. The fact that you have two congresswomen supporting BDS publicly, and they did not get thrown out of Congress the first day, is an indicator. The fact that you have Senator Bernie Sanders and Dianne Feinstein publicly issuing a statement defending the right to BDS, that says a lot. The fact that the New York Times published two articles about my entry ban to the United States in less than 5 days is a tiny indicator, but it's an indicator. It's the New York Times, for God's sake. So it says something. But we've seen BDS reach the mainstream among pension funds around the world, divesting from Israeli banks or American companies like Caterpillar, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola Solutions and others because of their involvement in the occupation and settlements. We've seen many, many, many artists join the cultural boycott of Israel, which is institutional, by the way. It doesn't target Israeli individuals because BDS does not target identity. It targets complicity. We're seeing Israel's isolation on the rise, despite Israel's ongoing economic and military power. Israel is a nuclear power with hundreds of nuclear weapons, and Israel's economy is still strong, mainly thanks to your tax money and your government. But its true face is being revealed to the world because it has dropped its last thin, worn-out mask of democracy and liberalism and so on, with this upcoming government, which will be the absolute most racist in Israel's history, with possibly fascist parties included in it, openly fascist parties included in it, Israel will have dropped its very final mask. While it can take pride that it has Bolsonaro in Brazil and Trump in the White House and Orban in Hungary and Modi in India supporting it so vividly with their hearts and every penny they have, well, and Saudi Arabia, of course, we shouldn't forget the beacon of democracy and enlightenment, the Saudi regime, is Israel's best friend now in the region. Well, congratulations for that, but you're losing the liberal mainstream around the world, including Jewish millennials. And this is a key point that Israel is not realizing. I think many people are saying that we should look at Palestine out of the Jewish box that Israel is trying to squeeze it in, with a redefinition of what that Jewish box is. In other words, what I mean is, there's nothing Jewish about Israel's oppression of the Palestinians. There's nothing Jewish about ethnic cleansing. There's nothing Jewish about occupation and ethnic cleansing and humiliating an elderly woman trying to cross a checkpoint to get treatment in a hospital in Jerusalem, or preventing women in Gaza with breast cancer. And my mother died recently of breast cancer. Preventing women in Gaza, tens and hundreds of women, from receiving breast cancer treatment outside of Gaza where there is no treatment. That cruelty is not Jewish. And everyone who says otherwise is an anti-Semite. And therefore, Israel makes an anti-Semitic statement when it says, we speak for all Jews. No, they don't. These are not Jewish values. Those are Israeli oppressive values that every libertarian, every human rights activist and advocate should reject.
So we have time for a handful of questions.
Read your interview in Middle East Eye, which was published today, and at the end of it, that things are so bad in Israel, especially with the government, that a global isolation of Israel would be appropriate at this point. And to me, that's much different than BDS, which just has company here, company there, whatever. But a real isolation is something different. And I would like to ask you to comment on the rationale for you saying that. And also, what are the implications in terms of travel and other kinds of things that so many Jews have relatives and friends. We travel back and forth all the time. And if that is something that should be considered.
Yes, thanks. Yes, when we call for isolating Israel's regime of oppression, we mean boycotts increasing, divestment increasing, and leading to what Brandt rightly said, the beginning of sanctions. If there's discussion now in Congress that military aid to Israel should be cut to tell Israel that you have to be held accountable like everyone else, that's a sanction. That's the beginning of sanction. And that's a sanction that's targeted against the regime of oppression, again, not against normal people. So we would oppose sanctions like those imposed on Iraq, for example, with no medicine, no food allowed, no fuel allowed, and so on. Those hurt people. Those hurt individuals. But there's so many sanctions that are definitely ethical, like cutting military aid to Israel. Stop giving Israel the ability to kill more of us, to demolish more of our homes, to maintain its oppression against us. The U.S. is the main reason why Israel's regime continues to oppress us. So cutting military aid to Israel is essential in the United States. It has to be part of our demands from colleges to city councils to churches to synagogues everywhere. So that's what we mean by isolating. Isolating includes academic and cultural boycotts, which target Israeli institutions that are complicit in Israel's violations of human rights. I don't know if that answers the question, or was there...
I was wondering about travel.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes, I forgot that part. Yeah. We recently issued guidelines for ethical visits, ethical tourism to the whole country, present-day Israel as well as the occupied territories. And we invite everyone to read those guidelines. They're on the BDS movement website, Ethical Tourism Guidelines, where we distinguish. We do not call for everyone not to visit the country. We understand, obviously, that many, many, many people have connection to this land, be it Jewish persons, Christians, Muslims, others. Many people have relatives or care a lot about visiting. But we want people to do that without doing harm. So our main slogan in that call is do no harm. You can visit without harming us by not using complicit airlines, complicit hotel companies, complicit bus companies, tour companies. There's a way to tour the area, to visit loved ones without crossing our picket line, so to speak. They're not very complex guidelines. They're really practical and reasonable, but very ethical.
Thing I wanted to add about the issue of travel is that it cuts both ways. I mean, Israel is increasingly making it more difficult for American Jewish activists to go into that country. I was just reading recently about a young woman who works for the Abraham Initiative, which is a liberal Zionist foundation that was not allowed in. It was in Haaretz. It was all over the press. And I remember thinking, you know, Palestinians' freedom of movement is barred every single day, and it's not front page news. But when a liberal Zionist Jewish woman is barred from entering in, suddenly that becomes newsworthy. And I think from a Jewish point of view, from an American Jewish point of view, I think we all should think seriously about the ethical ramifications of travel there and the fact that we have privilege to be able to enter that country whenever we want. We can become a citizen immediately when we enter that country, and that is a right that is denied to millions of Palestinians who have deep history there. So I think the issue of travel and freedom of movement is a very fraught one, and I think it presents a real challenge for us to think seriously about the sacrifices that we might be willing to make in the name of solidarity. So... some more questions. Scout?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Hi. Hi. Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor. So we spoke a lot about some of the work, organizing work, and opinions of millennials in our country, millennial Jews. It would be great to hear you talk a little bit about youth support or youth relationship to the BDS movement.
Maybe if you could speak a bit slower, because I couldn't hear some words. They were cut off.
I'm so nervous. Okay.
Can you... So am I.
That's so nice. Okay. Can you speak about the youth movement's support and or relationship with BDS and the BDS movement?
Palestinian youth movement or general around the world?
I would say Palestinian youth movement is
important. Palestinian.
But, sure. You know, all young people are important.
Okay. Thanks for that. When BDS was launched in 2005, the absolute majority of Palestinian society supported it. All the major entities, you know, trade unions, women's unions, farmers unions, and so on. But the actual doers and shakers are the youth. The actual activists on the ground, mostly women, by the way, I have no sociological explanation for this, but around the world, women happen to be much more active in BDS than men. No idea why, but that's how it is. And in the BDS movement in Palestine, at all levels, because I heard that from a feminist, yeah, women are always the doers, but they never make it to the top. Not in BDS. They're everywhere, on top and everywhere. And actually, we don't have a very top, because it's a very collective movement. We don't have a leader, a president, a chairman. It's all collective decision-making. So youth find this environment to be very conducive to their thinking, to their initiative, and very empowering. Because it's collective, because it's democratic, they're allowed finally to speak out and to express their views and ideas. So we do have a lot of youth support on the ground, especially in actual campaigns from Palestinian youth. And if you go to US campuses, which is a new phenomenon to me, when I went to school in the US, that was in the dark ages in the 1980s, there were very, very few Palestinian activists on US campuses. Very rarely. Most activists were non-Palestinian. Today, in most campuses, including Ivy League, UC Berkeley, Stanford, the top universities, there's an enormous number of Palestinian students, especially Palestinian women students, who are leading the work. And of course, a disproportionately high number of Jewish students, which we're very proud of.
Yes, could you elaborate a little more on the right of return aspect? I think many of us who've learned a little realize that this is not really that unrealistic, even in a rather robust way. On the other hand, it seems that as a practical matter, there would not be necessarily a massive influx of Palestinians into the state of Israel. That might, but on the other hand, and yet it's perhaps understandable that the BDS movement, the Palestinians, would not want to sort of compromise the principle by elaborating on the potentially limited impact of it. How would you put together all of those things in terms of how you would describe the reality of it, which may help in terms of explaining it here?
As a morally consistent human rights movement, we call for the rights of refugees everywhere in the world. Palestinian refugees deserve equal rights to all refugees. Jewish refugees from World War II, Kosovo, Bosnia, Darfur, any refugee community around the world has the same right. The right to return and the right to reparations. This is inherent in international law. As Human Rights Watch reminded Bill Clinton, Yasser Arafat, and Ehud Barak when they were negotiating in Camp David in 2000, it reminded them that you cannot negotiate away the right of return because it's unextinguishable under international law. Every single refugee has to make that decision, not just the collective. It's every single refugee makes that decision. So that's the principle that BDS defends. As a movement, we do not go further in outlining the parameters of the return because it's beyond our mandate. The United Nations is there to develop such guidelines, to develop such parameters for refugees' returns. And indeed, they have. In the case of Kosovo, in former Yugoslavia, the UN developed mechanisms for return and reparation that would limit any undue injustice to the to those who have settled in refugees' homes. But as I said, this is beyond the BDS mandate. I've personally, because I'm interested in this issue, I'm interested in how to establish a shared democracy with the rights of everyone, including refugees, I've developed some of those thoughts and I published them in Mondowise. Jewish Voice for Peace put together a number of essays in Mondowise about imagining the future. And I had an essay there, Reimagining Palestine as a Secular Democracy with Equal Rights for All, where I developed some ideas. So I invite you to read that article, but it's way beyond the BDS mandate. It's my personal views. But to me, we always have to take the ethical consideration into question. We should never let go of the ethical principle that we should never do undue harm to anyone.
Let's have time for one more question.
Two-part question. One, what is the trend that you've seen within the leftist organizations and movements around the world as a response And second, what are the objections you've seen? Because I've seen kind of a big mix of these two, and I'm wondering what the inside view is from BDS and how you envision those collaborations with the leftist political environment.
In fact, over the last few years, we've seen BDS grow much stronger into the progressive mainstream, if you will, whereas it wasn't the case a few years ago. A few years ago, it was just the solid left that would support BDS or would support BDS measures. As I mentioned today, in every progressive community, from activists in the Presbyterian Church to the United Methodist Church to many other trade unions in Europe, pension funds, and so on, BDS has managed to have some impact in those entities. And increasingly, it is building intersectional alliances with various justice struggles. I mentioned the Black community in the US. That's strategically, we're focusing a lot on the natural alliance with the Black community in the US, because we see their struggle for Black liberation, for their justice, is very much in line, in harmony with our own struggle. But also many other communities. I'll give you an example. Our call for a boycott of the Eurovision in apartheid Tel Aviv was endorsed over the last few weeks by more than 100 LGBTQ groups in Europe. This is unprecedented. We never had this many groups, LGBT groups in Europe, endorse BDS, endorse a boycott of Tel Aviv, of apartheid Tel Aviv and Eurovision. So we're seeing a lot of traction in those spaces. And that's why the repression has increased tremendously by Israel. A full ministry in the Israeli government, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, is dedicated to fighting BDS. They and the lobby groups are spending hundreds of millions of dollars annually to fight BDS. Some Israeli leaders are totally irrational, but the whole establishment is not. They're still rational. They wouldn't invest hundreds of millions of dollars in fighting something unless it's costing them billions of dollars. And more importantly, it's costing the regime legitimacy. And they understand that. Israel's regime today is losing its legitimacy as an apartheid regime, as a colonizing regime. It's losing its legitimacy thanks to its own deeds of brutality against Palestinians. Give credit where credit belongs. The Netanyahu regime has truly helped BDS. We have a closet member in the cabinet there. But it's also our strategic, inclusive, anti-racist work that has led to this result. And everyone who played a role in supporting BDS takes credit. All of us take credit. It's a collective movement. It's a universal movement.
Well, that's a wonderful place for us to end, I think. Please join me in thanking Omar.
And I repeat my wishes for a happy Passover. And I truly hope next year I'll be with you in person, hopefully, wishing you Passover, yes. A happy Passover in person.
Next year in Chicago. Omar, I'm delighted that Tzedek Chicago has allowed you the opportunity to keep alive your record of being able to meet all of your stops along your American itinerary. We wish you a Mabruk and a Mazel Tov on your daughter's wedding. And as this is truly a historic moment, let's all say together the blessing. Those of you who know the blessing, please join together. If you don't know the blessing, give a rousing amen. It's the Hebrew blessing for expressing gratitude at being sustained long enough to arrive at a very significant and sacred moment in one's life. We say together, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, shechianu v'kimanu v'higianu lazman hazeh.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.